بشرى لأرض نزلتم في نواحيها كأنكم ماطر أحيا سواقيها ترنو لكم كلما لح المصيف لها حبا لنور الهدى والشوق حاديها بشرى لأرض نزلتم في نواحيها
بشرى بشرى بشرى
كأنكم ناطر أحيا سواقيها
بشرى بشرى بشرى
لكم كل ما لح المصيف لها
بشرى بشرى بشرى. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته وعنا ونكسن دقستيال meel kasto aad joogtaan iyo si waliba aad noo maqleysaan ku soo dhawaada barnaamijka caalamul yawm. Qodobada maanta aad ku maqli doontaan waxaa ka mid ah saldhig ay leeyihiin ciidanka Suudaan oo ku yaala dhulka hoostiisa oo laga helay dalkaasi, iyo dowladda Iran oo loo badinayo inay dhisatay. Wadahadallada u dhexeeya Mareykanka iyo Iran oo ka bilowday magaalada Masqad ee caasimadda waddanka Cumaan, haddaba maxaa natiijo ah oo ka soo baxay maamulka gumaystaha Yahuudda oo sheegay inuu weerarayo Dahraan xitaa haddii heshiis uu dhex maro Washington iyo Dahraan? Qodobadaas xubintii wargeysyada iyo xalqadii labaad filim documentary ah oo mu'asasada Al-Kataib ay ka soo saartay dhagaraha Bangiga Adduunka iyo hay'adda IMF ayaad barnaamijka uga bogan doontaan. Ee waa mar kale iyo caalamul yawm.
لأرض نزلت في نواحيها
بشرى بشرى بشرى
كأنكم ناطر أحيا سواقيها
بشرى بشرى بشرى
لكم كل ما لح المصيف لها
بشرى بشرى بشرى. وهجاج وما لنما أحد هو تاريخ دوكو بغانت هايشان يتبنك الشوال سنة داكون أفر بقول أفرتني لحجري مركا ليكو سودا وادا برامشكا عالم اليوم قضبكا وقوه رينا وحاو نقنيا. Wadahadallo u dhexeeya dowladaha Mareykanka iyo Iran ayaa ka furmay magaalada Masqad ee caasimadda waddanka Cumaan. Dhanka kale, maamulka gumaystaha Yahuudda ayaa sheegay inuu weerarayo Dahraan xitaa haddii heshiisadaasi ay miro dhalaan. Qodobkaas iyo kuwo kale waxaad ku maqleysaan xubinta wargeysyada oo alaab halkan inooga soo jeediyo walaalkeen Ilyaas Cabdullaahi.
Suubaad baad u mahadsan tahay waxaad dhegeystayaal ku soo dhowaataan xubinta wargeysyada oo aad uga bogataan canaawinta ugu waaweyn ee ay nashriyaan joornaalada ka soo baxa dunida. Qodobka ugu horeeya ee aan ku eegi doonana waxa uu noqonayaa saldhig dhulka hoostiisa ah oo ay leeyihiin ciidanka Suudaan oo daaha laga soo rogay laguna tilmaamay mid xasaasi ah. Sida uu baahiyey joornaalka Ruushiyaanka ah ee Pravda, waxaa lagu waramayaa in baaritaanno in muddo ah qaatay kadib daaha laga soo rogay saldhig godad ka kooban oo dhulka hoostiisa ku yaala, waxa uuna saldhiggan si gaar ah ugu yaalaa gudaha dalka Suudaan iyadoo ay ka howlgalaan ciidanka militariga waddankaas ee uu hogaamiyo General Abdul Fitah al-Burhan. Waxay sidoo kale warbixintu ay sheegaysaa in saldhiggan loo badinayo in halkan ay ka dhiseen ciidanka ilaalada kacaanka Iran si ay ugu garab istaagaan militariga Suudaan oo waayihii dambe loolan xoogan kula jiray maleeshaadka Janjaweedka. Waxaa xogta jirirada sidoo kale lagu sheegayaa in saldhiggan uu leeyahay ilaa 12 albaab oo laga galo. Waxaa la soo bandhigay sawir uu qaaday mid ka mid ah dayax gacmeedyada, waxuuna si guud ahaaneed u muujinayaa shakliga saldhiggan. Waxuuna ku yaalaa dhul buuraley ah oo aysan dadi ka agdhoweyn. Qaabdhismeedkiisa ayaana lagu tilmaamay mid istaraatiiji ah, waxaana la aaminsan yahay in la dhisay intii uu bilowga ahaa dagaalka ka dhex aloolsan RSF iyo militariga Suudaan, iyadoo xilligaas la xusuustay in Iran ay ka mid ahayd dowladihii ugu horreeyey ee sida degdegsiimada ku laran tahay uga soo jawaabay codsigii militariga Suudaan, iyagoo siiyey tababare ciidan diyaaradaha aan duuliyaha lahayn, sidoo kalena la falanqeynayo warbixinada sirdoon. Sahaynada uu ku hanjabtay in ay u diyaar garoobayaan weerar kama dambeys ah oo ay ku qaadaan gudaha dalka Iran, xitaa haddii Trump uu garabkooda ka baxa markan. Waa qodob kale oo aan ku milicsan doonno xubinta wargeysyada. Sida uu saacadihii lasoo dhaafay ku waramayo wargeyska ka soo baxa deegaanada Yahuudda iyo Dicood Axranood, maamulka gumaystaha Yahuudda ayaa isku diyaarinaya weerar uu ku qaado gudaha dalka Iran, gaar ahaan xarumaha nukliyeerka. Waxay sidoo kale jiriradu ay sheegaysaa in maamulka sahaynada uu markan diyaar u yahay si kama dambeys ah in weerar uugu qaado gudaha xukuumadda Tehran, xitaa haddii maamulka Mareykanka uu garabkiisa ka baxo. Dhanka kale, jiriradaha ka soo baxa Bariga Dhexe ayaa toddobaadkii lasoo dhaafay si aad ah u daabacayay warbixino tooshka ku ifinaya ilaa labadii safar ee uu Benjamin Netanyahu ku tagay gudaha dalka Mareykanka tan iyo caleemasaarkii Donald Trump, iyagoo xusaya in ajandayaashii ugu waaweynaa ee uu Netanyahu miiska soo saaray ay qayb ka ahaayeen sidii loo kala dhantaali lahaa awoodda nugliyeer ee Iran iyo sidii weerar toos ah loogu qaadi lahaa haddii xukuumaddan uu majraha u haya Mascuud Bazashkiyaan ay ka madax taagta ajandayaasha Mareykanka iyo maamulka gumaystaha Yuhuudda oo isku duuban. Haddii aan intaa uga tallaabno qodobkaas, aan markan milicsanno warbixin ka hadlaysa wadahadalladii Mareykanka iyo Iran wejigoodii koowaad oo saacadihii lasoo dhaafay qabsoomay, haddaba maxaa natiijo ah oo ka soo baxay? Innagoo soo xiganayna warbixino kala duwan oo ay saacadihii lasoo dhaafay nashriyeen joornaalada ugu afka dheer Bariga Dhexe iyo Galbeedkuba, waxaa lagu waramayaa in saacadihii lasoo dhaafay wadahadalladii la qorsheynayay in ay ka dhacaan gudaha dalka Cumaan ay u qabsoomeen sidii loo qorsheeyey. Iran iyo Mareykanka ayaana yeeshay kulan aanan toos ahayn, taasoo meesha ka saartay sheegashadii Donald Trump ee toddobaadkii hore, taasoo ahayd in Iran ay la yeelan doonaan wadahadal toosa. Wasiirka arrimaha dibadda Cumaan Badr al-Buzaydi ayaa ahaa ninka keliya ee labada dhinac u kala dabqaadayay. Wafdiga Iran wadahadalkan uga qayb galay waxaa hogaaminaya wasiirka arrimaha dibadda, halka wafdiga Mareykankuna uu hogaaminaya ergeyga Trump u qaabilsan arrimaha Bariga Dhexe. Ilaa hadda ma jiraan go'aamo toos ah oo ka soo baxay wadahadalkan, waxaana la isku afgartay in wadahadalladu ay yeeshaan weji labaad, kaasoo la isku imaan doono 19 bishan aynu ku guda jirnay Abriil, kana dhac doona isla waddankan Cumaan. Gunaanadkii wasiirada arrimaha dibadda Iran ayaa ku tilmaamay wadahadalladii saacadihii lasoo dhaafay dhacay kuwo ku dhammaaday jawi degan oo ku salaysan is-ixtiraamid labada dhinac ah. Ruushku waxa uu ku fikirayaa in hawada sare uu geeyo hub nugliyeer ah. Waa ciwaanka warbixin uu daabacay wargeyska maalinlaha ah ee Sharqul Awsad. Xogta jirirada ayaa ugu horreyntii ku bilaabaysa in isbahaysiga NATO uu walaac ballaaran ka muujinayo suuragalnimada in Ruushka uu hawada sare geeyo qaar ka mid ah hubkiisa nugliyeerka, weliba muddo aanan fogeyn oo mustaqbalka dhow ayay jiriradu leedahay. Xoghayaha guud ee NATO oo ay majaladdu soo xiganaysa ayaana yidhi, waan ka warhaynaa wararka sheegaya in Ruushku uu ku fikirayo suuragalnimada in hubkiisa nugliyeerka uu geeyo hawada sare. Sidaa darteed, waxaa xusid mudan in saameynta hubka nugliyeerka in hawada sare uu geeyo Ruushka ay ka saacidi doonto in si wanaagsan uu u sii hagaajiyo awooddiisa difaaceed. Xubnaha kala duwan ee gaashaanbuurta NATO ayaa arrinkan si aad ah walaac uga muujinaya, waxaana warbixintan qoobgiriir milatari mar kale ay ku noqonaysaa dhammaan wadamada Yurub ee qaybta ka ah NATO. Guud ahaaninahaas ayaan ku hakininaa xubinta oo aad ku maqasheen qodobo kala duwan, waadna ku mahadsan tihiin dhegaysigeeda. Aan iminkana idinku wareejiya walaalkiin Shuaib Cabdulaahi iyo qaybaha inooga haray barnaamijka Caalamul Yoom.
Waa hagaag. Mu'asasada Al-Kataib ayaa faafisay qaybta labaad filim dokumentari ah oo loogu magacdaray dhagaraha bangiga adduunka ee hay'adda IMF. Xalqadan ayaana loogu soo qaadanayaa waxa loogu yeero deynacafinta iyo qodobada halista ah ee ku hoos duugan. Ku soo dhawaada isdaarkaas oo maqal ah.
Bismillaahirrahmaanirrahiim.
وَإِذَا قِيلَ لَهُمْ لَا تُفْسِدُوا فِي الْأَرْضِ قَالُوا إِنَّمَا نَحْنُ مُصْلِحُونَ أَلَا إِنَّهُمْ هُمُ الْمُفْسِدُونَ وَلَكِنْ لَا يَشْعُرُونَ
The involvement of the International Monetary Fund in Somalia from the 1960s to the 1980s played a significant role in the country's economic trajectory. Somalia's interactions with the IMF expanded in the early 80s during the rule of the apostate dictator Mohamed Siad Barre. At the time, Somalia was grappling with significant economic challenges, prompting the IMF to introduce its first structural adjustment program. The program granted the Barre regime access to loans, but came with stringent conditions that reshaped Somalia's economic landscape. These included, among other things, requiring the Somali government to adopt liberal economic reform policies aimed at creating an environment more conducive to foreign investment. As a result of IMF's reforms and conditionalities, Somalia's economy became open to foreign investment, attracting international investors, including Italian businessmen. The Italians entered into negotiations with the Somali government, exploring potential private investments in the banana industry, one of the country's key agricultural sectors. By 1982-83, the talks culminated in the creation of Somalfruit, a joint venture between Somalia and the Italian Dinadai Group. However, as was typical of IMF policies, the reforms disproportionately benefited foreign interests at the expense of the local population. While the policy modernized the banana production and increased exports, it did little to improve the conditions of the underpaid Somali workers who were toiling on the plantations. Despite the surge in exports, 75% of the revenue from exports left the country, benefiting foreign stakeholders rather than ordinary Somali people. The situation was further exacerbated by the harsh working conditions on the banana plantations, where workers labored for over 12 hours a day with only a 40-minute break at noon. Despite their efforts, they earned less than 10 U.S. cents a day, an amount barely enough to cover the cost of basic necessities like bread or rice. In essence, the Muslims of Somalia were exploited to work under grueling conditions for the benefit of an Italian company, while their country's resources were drained, all as a result of the IMF policies. Apart from the liberalization of the economy, other IMF policies included privatizing public services, devaluing the currency, and cutting public sector spending. Collectively, these policies set the stage for Somalia's eventual collapse in 1991. Between 1987 and 1989, the Somali currency was devalued by 460%, making exports cheaper for foreigners, but severely hurting domestic consumers as the cost of food and transportation increased drastically. Additionally, widespread layoffs as a result of these policies led to mass unemployment, further destabilizing the local economy. And as the years went by, this resulted in growing unrest in urban areas, while the dictator on his part became increasingly repressive. The IMF program also worsened existing clan conflicts in the country. To make matters worse, Barre's regime diverted 47% of the country's export earnings to foreign creditors rather than use the funds to alleviate the suffering of the local population. This outcome was typical of IMF policies, as they are designed to prioritize creditor interests over the stability and well-being of the host country. By 1991, under these circumstances and mounting pressure from within the country, Mohamed Siad Barre was overthrown and the country plunged into civil war. In the chaos that ensued, the IMF severed its relationship with Somalia, and it wasn't reestablished until 22 years later under another apostate leadership.
Good morning, everybody.
In early 2013, the apostate president Hassan Sheikh Mahmoud set out on a mission to reestablish Somalia's relations with the international community. His government entered into negotiations with the IMF, leading to an agreement in April 2013. As part of the agreement, the IMF officially recognized the new government, but in return, Somalia had to acknowledge and repay the presumed debt accumulated under the Barre regime.
On the 12th of April 2013, the Somali government officially signed an agreement with the IMF, acknowledging to pay back its historical debts. Many of these debts were unsubstantiated, and others were outright usurious. They were debts that, according to international law, the Somali government had a right to reject because they were odious debts without any foundation. And if you were to trace back these debts, you'll find that there is no evidence to substantiate the claims, and it would be impossible to conduct an audit trail.
To understand the gravity of the apostate government's decision to blindly accept the presumed debts, it's important to consider the nature of the loans given to post-colonial African countries from the 1960s onward. Throughout this period, many African nations, including Somalia, were ruled by military dictatorships. Despite knowing that they were dealing with corrupt and irresponsible leaders, international financial institutions like the IMF and the World Bank still continued to grant them loans.
And it's very important to note that normally, like for the great majority of the loans that were given out, they were given to dictators, to unaccountable leaders. So it's not like Suharto was like, okay, let me take this deal. Let me go check with the people. Let's see if they consent. This was never the case. So they were like, fine, like essentially, and I'll explain the conditions, but like they were like, we'll implement the conditions. Just give me the money. They never planned to pay it back. They knew that they didn't have to pay it back, in fact, and they would spend the money on weapons and on security forces and on palaces and on just general petty corruption. And then maybe a small amount would get left over to actually fund infrastructure and like good things for the people. But most of it was just like drained away from them.
The lenders responsible for disbursing these loans, including the IMF, World Bank, major commercial banks, and wealthy Western nations, were not naive or unaware of their actions. They were fully aware that African dictators were unlikely to repay these loans, yet they continued to lend to them. These lenders prioritized short-term gains over long-term sustainability of the loans. This short-sighted approach led to what is known as loan pushing, an aggressive practice of promoting and selling as many loans as possible, often with little regard for the borrower's ability to repay or the long-term consequences. In addition to that, an internal World Bank evaluation in 1992, known as the Wappenhans Report, revealed that 37.5% of the bank's projects completed in 1991 were categorized as failures, a sharp increase from 15% a decade earlier. This dramatic increase indicated a continuous pattern of poor lending practices and ineffective project outcomes. Similarly, a 1998 World Bank report acknowledged that financial agencies were focused more on disbursing funds than ensuring their effective use. This led to a predatory push for loans, where large sums of money were lent to poorly managed economies, yielding little tangible benefit for the population of the borrowing countries. Further evidence indicates that a significant portion of the funds meant for development in Africa either never reached the continent or was siphoned off by corrupt individuals and their associates. This misuse of funds has led to what is known as odious debt. These are debts incurred by governments for reasons that the lenders fully understood would not benefit the country and, in fact, would go against its real needs and interests. Essentially, this means that much of Africa's debt is unfair and non-binding because the money was incurred by despotic regimes who used it to further repress their populations. And as such, there is no reason why African people should be held accountable for them. Instead, it is the creditors who knowingly lent money to corrupt leaders who should bear the blame, and not the populations of these countries.
My opinion is that a large part of the debt is what is technically called odious debt. Now, that's a concept that was invented by the United States back in 1898, when the United States essentially conquered Cuba. It's called liberating Cuba, but essentially preventing Cuba from liberating itself from Spain, which is in fact what happened. The U.S. was in control of Cuba, and it did not want, Cuba had a huge debt to Spain, and the United States didn't want to pay it. So they declared it to be what's called odious debt, meaning, which is a proper notion in my view. It meant the debt was not incurred by the people of Cuba. It was incurred by the dictators, you know, the rulers, and it's not the fault of the population. So there's no reason why they should pay it. So therefore, the U.S. refused to pay the debt to Spain. If I lend you money, and I know that you're a pretty risky borrower, so therefore I demand high interest, and I enrich myself from the interest that you're paying me. And if at some point you can't pay, if in a capitalist system it's my problem, that's basically what the debt is. So in most of these countries, the debt has to do with the banks. It's not the public.
Given the well-documented history of predatory lending practices by institutions like the IMF, World Bank, and other major creditors, one would think that any responsible leader would take the time to thoroughly research and verify historical debts before blindly accepting them. Unfortunately, responsibility and accountability seem to be absent from the lexicon of the apostate Somali government. Desperate for international recognition, they agreed to repay the presumed loans, along with the accrued interest. After sifting through the debts, we discovered that we don't have any evidence to verify their authenticity. They just told us that we incurred such debts and that we must pay them. As for the debts we allegedly incurred, we cannot verify whether we actually received the money or not. That is because all the documents that were in Mogadishu were destroyed during the civil war. Therefore, we are forced to just accept whatever is dictated to us. The apostate Somali government claims that they had no choice but to comply with IMF's regulations. The truth, however, is that they were simply weak, subservient, and eager to align themselves with their foreign benefactors, because even according to their own disbelieving legal frameworks, they had options to challenge the debt, but chose to act as mere puppets. A notable example is Ecuador. In 2008, Ecuador's president refused to service the country's foreign debt, asserting that it was illegitimate. Ecuador established a commission to thoroughly audit the debt. By September 2008, the commission revealed that a substantial portion, two-thirds of the loans, had been allocated to military expenditures under the dictatorship that ruled the country in the 1970s, a situation reminiscent of the era of Somali dictator Mohamed Siad Barre. Additionally, the report confirmed the predatory practices of the creditors, who imposed unjust conditions on Ecuador in collusion with corrupt national leaders. In the case of Somalia, the precise amount of the presumed debt was not even known to start with, and no responsible leader should have accepted a figure that was plucked out of thin air, but the spineless apostate leaders accepted it anyway. What demonstrates the deception of the creditors was that in 2013, independent sources estimated Somalia's presumed debt at $3.054 billion, but the IMF reported a much higher figure of $4.989 billion, creating a discrepancy of nearly $2 billion. Despite this glaring issue, Somalia's apostate leadership accepted the inflated amount without protest. Even this significant revelation did not sway the weak apostate leaders from continuing to submit to the foreign powers, on the premise that they were now on the road towards debt relief. To fully grasp the implications of this situation, it is essential to delve into the details of Somalia's so-called debt relief and understand the true nature of the agreements made. In December 2023, the apostate Somali government proudly celebrated what it portrayed as a monumental achievement of reaching the completion point of the IMF's Heavily Indebted Poor Countries Initiative, or HIPC. The event was marked with grand declarations of success, but in the midst of the celebrations, the apostate officials gave conflicting figures on the amount that was presumably forgiven. The Prime Minister even gave the impression that the country was now completely debt-free.
We have received a debt relief of $5.3 billion. Today, the debt of $5 billion that we owed has been forgiven. Welcome. Tonight's celebration marks the great victory achieved by Somalia in debt relief, which was announced just hours ago. Somalia has had more than $5 billion in debt written off.
Contrary to the apostate official's blatant lies, Somalia received $4.5 billion in so-called debt relief. The truth was that the country still faced a considerable amount of debt and was still mired in IMF's classical debt trap. According to the IMF, Somalia's total debt stood at approximately $766 million by the end of 2023, the majority of which was owed to external creditors. But that's not all. Somalia also owed an additional debt of 79 million SDR directly to the IMF as of June 2024. This amount translates to approximately $107 million. Throughout their campaign for HIPC completion, the apostate government repeatedly misled the public, using the term debt relief to suggest that all debts were erased, when in reality, the HIPC initiative only reduces the debt to a level considered sustainable by the IMF. This means Somalia is still far from being debt-free, and a significant burden still remains, one that the apostate government will eventually expect the people to bear. By engaging in the HIPC initiative, the apostate government agreed to pursue an economic policy that had to be approved in Washington, effectively surrendering the country's economic sovereignty to the IMF and World Bank, with the $4.5 billion merely serving as the price tag. This wasn't an act of charity, but a calculated surrender of national economic control for a measly value. This loss of economic sovereignty became increasingly apparent through the numerous stringent conditions that the IMF imposed on the Somali government during the so-called debt relief process. Far from having the flexibility to implement their own independent economic and social policies, the apostate government was essentially left with no choice but to submit to the conditions set by the IMF.
IMF World Bank, waxayna soo hordhigeen 84 shuruud.
The IMF and World Bank presented us with 84 conditions. It wasn't easy. Over the course of 3 to 4 years, the Somali government had to meet 84 conditions in order to reach a point where the possibility of debt relief could even be discussed. I remember that the conditions that we had to reach were over 90 performance targets. Some of the indicative targets were very strict. You either fail or you pass, there is nothing in between. For example, there were specific revenue goals you could not fall below, and similarly, certain expenditure limits that you could not exceed. As a government, you have many needs to tend to and projects to accomplish, but the IMF and World Bank do not allow you to manage your revenues according to your needs. You have to follow strict conditions, and any deviation, whether too low or too high, would result in failure. If you fall short of the revenue target, you fail. If you exceed the expenditure limit, you fail. If you fall short on the balances, you fail. When you look at all these conditions, you realize it was not a simple task to manage. This was no small feat. The IMF is merciless and operates on a strict pass or fail basis. Either you meet the targets or you don't. There is no middle ground. You either succeed or you don't. There's no halfway point. By their own admission, the conditions set by the IMF were mandatory, and failure to meet them meant that there would be no reduction. This dynamic has been openly criticized by former World Bank chief economist, who admitted that such debt relief programs only serve to expand the influence and authority of the IMF. Under these arrangements, it is the IMF, not the debtor country, that ultimately determines and approves the country's economic policies, and without their approval, no debt relief is granted. These set of conditionalities only aid in propagating economic policies favorable to the creditors, preventing the people of the country from formulating policies aligned with their own development priorities. Essentially, the HIPC initiative is a powerful tool in the hands of creditor nations through which they impose their economic ideology on poor nations who have no other choice but to submit to them. Instead of boasting about their so-called triumph, the apostate leaders should have been honest with the Somali people and told them the truth. What they hailed as debt forgiveness was nothing more than a shameless trade-off. Somalia auctioned off its economic sovereignty
for over $4.5 billion to international financial institutions while still owing over $700 million. As for the creditor nations and institutions, the HIPC initiative was a grand success, ensuring that developing countries open up their economies, privatize their public companies, reduce public spending, and eventually repay their remaining debt, all the while remaining subservient to their IMF masters. In Somalia, the effects of IMF policies have been profound and directly impacted the lives of the Somali people. During his tenure, the former apostate president, Mohamed Abdullahi Farmajo, proudly celebrated the opening up of the economy.
We have to increase trade and bring in foreign investors. We have to liberalize trade and turn the country into a free enterprise economy.
The outcome of this destructive policy was that the Somali market was soon flooded with cheap imported goods, including items that were readily available locally. This shift did not go unnoticed by the residents of Mogadishu, who saw firsthand how their local market was flooded with foreign products.
My name is Abdurrahman Abukar Jailani. In the past, I was involved in the local fruit and vegetable trade, but recently we've seen an influx of imported produce from countries like Egypt and other places. I see it as a major problem, especially because we have fertile land, and we should be the ones supplying the market with fresh produce.
My name is Hawo Hassan. It's surprising that we are importing fruits like mangoes from Egypt and other places. Our country is a large one, rich in rivers and fertile land, and we are capable of growing our own food. We need to focus on consuming what our country produces because it's the livelihood of our people. We don't want to rely on food imported from outside. Somalia is in a state of despair. Just the other day, I saw carrots being imported and unloaded at the airport. It's a misfortune for our country and a humiliation for our people. I feel like we're witnessing a deterioration of our people. Somalia is being undermined on all fronts, and I urge my fellow citizens to wake up, take action, and start working for the betterment of our country. Let us focus on cultivating our land and taking care of our people so that we can stand strong and not let our enemies weaken us.
Furthermore, the policy of reduction in social spending became clearly evident when the apostate government immediately made significant cuts to the health budget in 2024. This was just one facet of the widespread devastation inflicted by the so-called debt relief program on Somalia, with the apostate leaders remaining passive and compliant to the dictates of the IMF vultures. The extent of the Somali government's subservience and the loss of the economic sovereignty to the IMF became even more clearer during the preparation of the so-called Poverty Reduction Strategy Paper, PRSP, in the course of their so-called debt relief efforts. According to IMF guidelines, for a country to be considered for the HIPC initiative, it was required to develop a poverty reduction strategy paper. This paper was supposedly meant to be a product of national ownership, formulated through a broad-based participatory and consultation process within the country it was being prepared. On the surface, it appeared to be a brilliant, altruistic, and generous initiative. But this was just another example of the IMF's skillful manipulation of language to project a positive image. The reality is that despite the frequent changes in terminology, acronyms, and consultation methods employed by the IMF and World Bank, their fundamental agenda has remained consistent throughout. Their primary focus is to serve the interests of creditors rather than genuinely addressing the needs and priorities of debtor nations. The Poverty Reduction Strategy Paper, PRSP, was ostensibly designed as a framework for countries to detail their approaches to combating poverty. Introduced by the IMF and the World Bank in the late 1990s, the PRSP was meant to replace the structural adjustment programs, which had faced significant criticism for their detrimental impact in developing countries. IMF's deception, however, was quickly unveiled. And when the PRSP framework was announced in September 1999, it was met with immediate scrutiny and backlash for being a repackaging of the same old structural adjustment policies. Critics quickly pointed out that despite the term poverty reduction strategy suggesting a greater emphasis on social factors, the PRSP simply rebranded the same structural adjustment policies under a new label. Moreover, despite the poverty reduction strategy paper being presented as a product of true national ownership, the World Bank and IMF retained the authority to veto the final programs, revealing the superficiality of the claim. In 2019, the apostate government submitted its poverty reduction strategy, known as the Ninth National Development Plan, NDP-9, to the IMF. The IMF even went on to claim that the document represented genuine national ownership. This claim, however, was deeply flawed. The NDP-9 was never a product of national ownership, and the vast majority of the Somali population still remains completely unaware of its existence or its contents. Furthermore, the document is not even available in the Somali language, raising serious questions about its local relevance and accessibility. In reality, the concept of national ownership is largely a facade. These documents are often drafted in English, a language that most of the local population does not understand. This illustrates that, despite the rhetoric of national ownership, real control remains with the IMF and World Bank. The role of finance ministers in exacerbating this servitude and hypocrisy cannot be ignored. According to an admission by one African finance minister, when preparing the poverty reduction strategy, they often anticipate the preferences of the IMF and World Bank, aiming to avoid criticism or severe reprimands from these institutions. This approach sends a clear signal to their IMF and World Bank overseers that they are supportive of structural adjustments. In essence, these ministers prioritize appeasing officials in Washington over addressing the needs of their own people. This attitude was candidly expressed by Somalia's former Minister of Finance, who stated that the most significant benefit they had gained from the debt relief program was an improved image with their international partners.
The first thing that we have achieved, and which I want the Somali people to understand, is the ability to sit down with people, sign agreements, and then fully implement what we've signed. What's important is that we have gained trust. For people to say that Somalia had signed agreements 2 years ago and then fulfilled them as promised, that is a key achievement. Despite the IMF and World Bank's determined efforts to portray themselves as charitable organizations by branding the poverty reduction strategy paper with a positive and optimistic name, the initiative proved to be an undeniable failure. The paper consisted largely of theoretical policies outlined out in extensive, jargon-filled documents, which failed to resonate with or address the real conditions faced by people on the ground. Instead of having a meaningful impact on poverty, the PRSP became another instrument for advancing Western neoliberal agendas in developing nations. Rather than fostering genuine development or alleviating poverty, it served to uphold the existing economic framework that benefited the interests of wealthier foreign nations, leaving the fundamental issues of inequality and underdevelopment unresolved.
The World Bank and the IMF have plans to reduce world poverty that they call poverty reduction strategy papers, which are laid out in a 1,246-page poverty reduction strategy paper source book. What really pains me about, as someone who works a lot with colleagues from Africa at NYU and colleagues that I meet when I travel to Africa, is that it seems like the campaign to sort of save Africa or save the poor of Africa is this sort of European American driven campaign that seems to have room for everyone except the Africans. You know, that there's no room for the sort of homegrown effort that would get started on its own and attract financing. So discard the whole model of structural adjustment lending, where you decide in Washington what a poor country should do and impose that plan from the top down. That has not worked. So discard that. get rid of the poverty reduction strategy papers. No one has ever ended poverty with a poverty reduction strategy paper. Get rid of the poverty reduction strategy papers. No one has ever ended poverty with a poverty reduction strategy paper.
To demonstrate the failure of the PRSP used in the HIPC initiative to reduce poverty, one only needs to observe that 8 of the world's 10 poorest countries in 2024 are nations that have reached the completion point of the HIPC program. The heavily indebted poor countries HIPC initiative was established with the goal of providing a lasting solution to the debt crisis of poor countries. And in that respect, it has not just failed, but did so miserably. There is a growing consensus that many African countries that have participated in the HIPC initiative still struggle with huge debts. Even countries that conscientiously fulfill IMF and World Bank requirements still fail to reduce external debt repayments to sustainable levels by the end of the process. The HIPC initiative has not succeeded in making unsustainable debt burden sustainable, despite that being its stated goal. By the end of 2023, a total of 37 countries had successfully completed the HIPC initiative, with 31 of them being in Africa. Yet, despite reaching the so-called completion point, data from the IMF and the CIA World Factbook reveals that all of these countries continue to struggle with massive debts owed to external creditors, including significant obligations to the IMF itself, and the promise of debt relief has done little to ease their financial burdens. Even countries that the apostate leaders have praised and encouraged the Somali people to emulate, such as Ivory Coast, Senegal, and Rwanda, have fallen short both in terms of reducing debt and alleviating poverty, despite supposedly benefiting from the full completion of the HIPC initiative.
It's possible for a country to make real progress after its debt relief. A shining example is Ivory Coast or Senegal, countries that have succeeded after their debt relief. Rwanda is another example of a nation that has shown remarkable improvement. We should follow the example of these countries and learn from their successes, as they have achieved tangible results. Despite these staggering levels of poverty and debt, the IMF, World Bank, and their defenders frequently argue that these countries are developing and their economies are growing. This argument is based on a capitalistic understanding of development and growth that focuses on numbers rather than people. In reality, development should be about transforming the lives of people, not just economic metrics. It's not about factories, dams, and roads, but how a country can cater for the social welfare of their people.
Somalia, galadu waxay ku tilmaamay inay tahay failed state ama fragile state.
The disbelievers often label Somalia as a failed state or fragile state due to its history of collapse and internal conflicts. They use this as a justification to impose their influence over the country's economy. However, the reality on the ground has taught us that the more Somalia remained independent from international systems such as the IMF and the World Bank, the more its economy improved. This is not just a claim we are making. It is a fact supported by research and data. One key report we can refer to is the 2008 study by George Mason University, titled Better Off Stateless. This report highlighted that the country's economy was actually better during the period of Somalia's state collapse than during times when a government was in power. The study also showed that, during the years of anarchy, Somalia's economic situation was often better than many other African countries in terms of both quality of life and economic activity, including trade and business growth. The report also confirmed that the Somali shilling was stronger than both the Ethiopian and the Kenyan currencies during that time. Our goal is not to suggest that people should live without a government or in chaos, but the reality is that the global system and institutions such as the IMF and the World Bank, as well as the apostate Somali leaders, have played a significant role in Somalia's economic stagnation and have contributed to the setbacks and poverty the country has faced.
Our goal is to make it clear to our people that it is possible to achieve financial stability, economic growth, and development without relying on the global system built on exploitation and usury.
As capitalist entities, the IMF and World Bank always prioritize the interests of creditors, viewing sustainability through a narrow economic lens rather than focusing on human and social development. The IMF is not a charitable or altruistic organization, but a key player in the global financial system, serving the interests of wealthy creditors. Its primary focus is ensuring that debts are repaid and financial stability is maintained for the benefit of its creditor stakeholders, with little regard for the negative impacts on the debtor nations and their populations.
The first issue is that the IMF's main task is to secure the interests of creditors, external creditors, mainly banks, but also other countries and international financial institutions. So the IMF is concerned mainly with liquidity and solvency at all costs. It has no interest whatsoever in social costs, political costs, and even trade costs. Are the collective policies and prescriptions of the IMF and the World Bank, known as the Washington Consensus, are these collective prescriptions and policies counterproductive or helpful? I have been advisor to a few governments in Central and Eastern Europe, and it is my view, for whatever it's worth, that bottom line, the IMF is counterproductive in its involvement in these countries. I have seen the Washington Consensus implemented in another continent, in Africa. Right. I have seen the Washington Consensus implemented in southeastern Europe, in the Balkans. And that's not a sight to behold.
All right.
The Washington Consensus safeguards the banks, not the countries.
The IMF continues, I think, as your report rightly suggests, to act as you, if you like, as a carbuncle on this great giant vampire, which is creditor interests around the world, i.e. the financial interests that have captured, in a sense, assets that have lent money to governments recklessly and now expect taxpayers to bail them out.
It's not a rescue of the countries concerned, it's a rescue of their creditors. And that, in combination with the austerity policies that have been part of the price of the so-called rescues, makes them extremely dubious from not simply an economic but also a moral perspective.
In the next and final part of this series, we'll examine the effects of IMF's heavily indebted poor countries initiative in Somalia and how the highly praised debt relief program turned out to be a catastrophe for the local population. We will explore how, instead of providing the promised relief, the initiative served merely to deepen the suffering of the Somali people, particularly through the introduction of taxation on an already struggling population.
Wahaga gudahan taas ayaan ku soo gabagabeynay barnaamijka Caalamul Yoom kulanti dambe ayaa ino balan ah sida ay nabad galiyo. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.